it was something that I didn't think was in the cards, and that it might be, that I thought it would be more useful to think about what can be done about the ANCSA and the other provisions made by Congress. The interesting thing is that the rights of Alaska Natives and of Native people in every country of the West are based on international law. The great American Chief Justice John Marshall developed the whole idea of Native sovereignty and Native Aboriginal title as we know it in the 1820s and 1830s, and he developed that notion by bringing international law in making it the basis for what then became the law of the United States. And then Canada adopted Marshall's ideas, and Australia has adopted them, and the Scandinavian countries, in dealing with their own indigenous populations, have adopted Marshall's ideas. Now, many legal thinkers feel that we have exhausted Marshall's ideas. It's a tribute to him that they've served reasonably well for 150 years. Now, many people believe we should be bringing international law back in, because, and of course, international law has changed. In John Marshall's day, if a European power sailed along the Aleutian chain and said, "We've discovered this, we claim it, it's ours," under international law, it became theirs. Now, the International Court of Justice at The Hague has ruled, in the case of of Western Morocco, that neither Morocco nor Spain, by simply discovering what is known as Western Morocco, where there are tribesmen living who claim it is theirs, that the theory of discovery is no longer valid in international law. And that is why some legal scholars want to bring international law back in, thinking it may refresh and replenish the original source. That is John Marshall's thinking. I know this is kind of long and complicated, but it's as far as I think has been gone giving legal recognition to the notion that peoples of the fourth world, the indigenous peoples, who are minorities, they aren't majorities like the peoples of Africa who claimed their independence after the war. They are minorities in the midst of Western countries. What institutions can be established to enable them to achieve some measure of self-government, to control their own land, to keep it in perpetuity, to decide what happens on that land? That's what lies really beneath all of this talk today about ANCSA. Congress chose one form of land holding and one form of self-determination for Native people. How has it worked out? And in deciding whether there are better ways of doing it in the future, this commission is actually looking at what other countries are doing. And we've had witnesses come from other countries to talk about how they've tried to accommodate the aspirations of indigenous peoples in their midst. We've had people from Scandinavia, indigenous people from Australia, from the lower 48, naturally, Canada, Greenland, and this is happening all over the world, and people are, indigenous people are claiming the right to have something to say about their own future. And so,
I'm glad you expanded that, because there are, interestingly, indigenous peoples who live in the midst of what are called today third world countries. I speak of Southern Africa, where there are indigenous peoples in the midst of the desert, who are neither Bantu peoples, as the majority hold in Southwest Africa, or what is that large desert country above South Africa? Its name is Botswana. There are native peoples in the Philippines and in Indonesia, and who are different racially from the majority peoples. There are native peoples throughout South America, Indian peoples, who are different from the Spanish and Portuguese dominated ruling classes of those countries. It would be very interesting to see not only how these people are doing, but how the acts and relationships of the United States to these countries reflect the treatment of these native peoples, as very often our foreign policy or foreign aid or our acts of war or acts of peace very profoundly change the lives and the fortunes and the health of these indigenous peoples. Specifically, I'm thinking of Southern Africa at this moment and South America, where these people are caught in a crossfire, a literal crossfire, with bullets.
Well, there, I mean, you've opened up a vast panorama of issues, but I can tell you that, well, I was in, was invited to be in Panama at this very time, this week, and I couldn't go, but there's a land claims movement in Panama by the Indians of Panama. There's a land claims movement in Brazil by the Indians of the Amazon. The Brazilian military is in the process of turning the government there over to civilian authority, and it's been recommended that there be a commission like this one to go into the Amazon to hear what those Indian people who live there want to do about their land and about their claim to govern themselves. You're quite right, and I'm sure, in saying that in many countries of the third world there are indigenous minorities. We, at least in the West, have a common legal tradition, and so there is a real possibility of learning from what is happening in other Western countries, that is, countries that share the tradition of the common law and parliamentary institutions, and we are learning from them, I think. But, you know, there are apparently 60 million tribal people in India.
Yes.
They have their own department of, it's not called Indian Affairs, but they are under a separate department of government, just like the BIA here in America, what we call the Department of Indian Affairs in Canada. So there are indigenous people in the Soviet Union, hundreds of thousands of them. We are, in fact, trying to arrange for some exchange with them so that we know what is happening there, if it is possible to find out.
We just brushed off by our senior senator from the state inquiring whether Aleut peoples who had been moved from these islands to the two commander islands, Beringia or Beringa and I don't remember the Molodnia, the two commander islands, which have Aleut-speaking peoples who were moved there by the Russian colonists in these late 1700s, early 1800s. No one has heard much from them lately, whatever lately means, since 1900. Well, these were the Russians. And it would be useful to find out what's happening with these people.
I know you worked with the National Geographic and all that, yes.
No.
It looks as if he does, though.
whatever efforts could be made on a low-key scale, I realize these islands have, on the one hand, large strategic significance in the eyes of the Russians, but in actual fact, zero strategic significance, what with satellite photography and surveillance. The United States also has some military installations on the outer Aleutian Islands, which make, I'm sure, the Soviet Union rather touchy. But as far as native peoples go, one, and their survival, and their movement from offshore settlements by the Soviet Union, which has happened in Big Diomede Island. The people are now dispersed thoroughly throughout eastern Siberia. The relatives of the St. Lawrence Islanders, who have been dispersed thoroughly from their shore settlements opposite St. Lawrence Island, it's a very large concern where the relatives and the same family members of the Aleut peoples, where are they? Can some contact be established? And if Senator Stevens is thoroughly disinterested and above this issue, perhaps through this commission, some feelers could be put out to achieve some visitation or some contact.
Well, we have been, we hope to make some possible, some exchange of information at least with the native peoples in the Soviet Union.
Been quiet a while. Do you have anything to add?
Yeah, I was going to ask something. Are you going to Attica too?
No, maybe Mary can deal with that.
Oh.
One of the board members of the Aleut Corporation from Attica has promised to collect testimony from everyone there and to bring it to us in Anchorage. I've been in phone contact with a number of people in Attica, and that was the best we could do. You know how much it costs to go there.
I know. Yeah, I'm just curious because my son was the first president of the Aleut League and Aleut Corporation, and he's there, you know. He could give you all the information you wanted.
What is his name, and I'll make sure that he's contacted.
Michael Swetsoff.
Okay, I did contact him.
Oh, you did. Okay.
Well, would you like to say anything, Mr. Hudson?
Too long of a cord here.
My name is Ray Hudson. I just want to follow up on what Walter Tellman was saying on UADC. I think it's been quite a valuable organization in the community. I think it's true that they've experienced frustration in part for a number of reasons, but partly because of the for a while, I think the indifference on the part of the Unalashka Corporation towards what UADC was trying to do. I think there's been a change in attitude towards UADC, and it hasn't been abandoned. It's been reinforced and strengthened. So I think that's a positive sign. Also, the comment of the city planner in terms of relationships between the Unalashka Corporation and the city, it may be good now, but it hasn't always been good. When the city was more active in terms of canneries in the area, and the city council was somewhat dominated by cannery people, then you had quite a bit of opposition to the Unalashka Corporation, and a number of difficult situations arose. So it hasn't always worked out smoothly. That's basically what I wanted to say.
Yeah. How long have you been in Unalashka?
I've been here since 1964.
Well, you must have been here through the whole land claims era, the
right.
passage of ANCSA, the formation of the corporations, and the current unease about the future. What do you make of it all, Mr. Hudson? You're a teacher here.
You're right, right. I see ANCSA has provided a kind of stability that wasn't here before, in the sense that there is a basis, an economic basis for native people that didn't exist prior to ANCSA. When I came here, the membership on the school board was all native. Membership on the city council was maybe half native, half non-native. And that was prior to the king crab industry. And then as the canneries began to come in and the population began to grow, membership of these bodies changed, and Aleut people had less to say in terms of what went on in the city, in terms of what went on at the school. The school board membership continued to be predominantly Aleut for quite a while. Eventually, it ended up so that there have been many years when there have been no Aleut people on the school board. And so the institution of the local corporation provided Aleut people with a very firm ground with which to deal with the influx of non-native people who were elected by the rest of the population to positions of authority in the community. And so I think it's been very healthy in the sense that people who have long-term bases in the community have been able to continue to make decisions about, you know, the resources in the community. Granted, they've had to make these decisions on the basis of being members of a corporation, a profit-making corporation. But I think one other thing maybe I should say is that I think one of the causes for differences of opinion or anger between the city council and the corporation in part has been the reluctance of the corporation to immediately jump into any project that's proposed to them. The fact that they've taken time to make decisions on the utilization of the resources that they have has sometimes been frustration for outside economic forces who wanted a decision right away and didn't get it. And I think, I don't know personally, I think that's healthy to take time to make the plans that you need to do. I think there's been a change too in the sense that with the institution of corporations and the fact that the corporation has a title to the prime property in this area, there is a prestige established or a prestige associated with being a member of the corporation. And that, I think, has been good. I see that in the school to some extent, reflected in students for whom being an Aleut means something that it didn't mean 20 years ago. And here we have the same, I think, questions that in other places people do in terms of, you know, granted we have the corporations, now how do we get students to develop the business skills that they need to make those corporations a success? At the same time, how do we get students to continue traditions that have nothing to do with corporations? Well, I think in this region, it's primarily the Aleutian Pribilof Island Association that's been involved with education. And again, it's through their Johnson O'Malley programs. They were a big help to us here in strengthening our local parent committee.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And another point you mentioned about education.
Yeah.
You say state is helping. Federal government issues the money to the state to teach the children, start off there.
Yeah.
You were putting down the state. The state brings in the money.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Could I ask a question, Mr. Hudson? You said that that prestige attaches to being a member of the corporation, that being an Aleut means something it didn't mean in years past, or the meaning has been acquired that didn't exist in years past. I know this is very hard to pin down, but from the point of view of your own observations, What is the difference? Can you articulate it, put it into words? What is the meaning that...
There used to be an expression that you would hear in town that I haven't heard for a long time, and that's dumb Aleut. I think the general feeling that people have for themselves has improved. I think with the I don't know if they're related or not, but with the development of the corporations, there's been a means of identifying yourself as an Aleut, and that's been a one way that that there was some kind of identity, because I think there's a great variety within the Aleut community in terms of skills, in terms of language, in terms of attachment to crafts, and it's just an extremely wide variety. I don't think the Aleut society has been a unified society for a long, long time. And I think prior to ANCSA, the more a person became absorbed into the mainstream and stopped native kinds of things, in a sense, the better off one was. There was some interesting correspondence in the 1930s regarding the school here. And it was being changed from a BIA, no, it was being changed from a territorial school to a BIA school. And the arguments given for not doing that was that although the children in Unalaska had some native blood in them, they had more white blood. And they were more like whites than they were like natives, and therefore they should have a territorial school and not a BIA school. It was that kind of attitude, I think, that resulted in people not identifying as Aleut people and not being interested in their Aleut heritage, because there was nothing, in a sense, that was of any value to outsiders, and for some reason that was an important thing to have. But the development of the corporations and the fact that the corporation is a prestigious institution and has property and has power in the community gave people something that they could say to other people, look, this is an effective organization, it's a strong organization, we're members of it. And at the same time, then the people who were in that organization began, and probably always had, to look at ways of strengthening the traditional values and the traditional culture and getting it into other parts of the community.
How long have you been with us in Alaska?
I've been here since 64. Well,
and how many children do you have? How many of them do you go to school?
Yeah.
Under Alaska, different cities, so really. How many children do you have going to school there right now? And what's the difference does it make to you? That's the one you said, what you're trying to say?
I guess what I'm trying, a lot of what I say has to do with the fact that when I first came here, or about a year after I came here, I met Anfisa Shapsnikov, and Mrs. Shepstakoff, and she was very interested and very concerned about, I think, what she viewed as the disappearance of Aleut culture. Yeah, yeah. And at the same time, she was very active. Yeah, and at the same time, she was extremely active in community affairs. She was on the city council. You know, and so the question of how you make a balance.
Yeah, there always are something to
it. Yeah, yeah.
Try to teach the whole thing at once.
Yeah, no, you can't. Yeah.
Quite a while to even get them really interested in it. You know, then once you
got well, now that this has been brought up, is the Aleut language still spoken? Is there any program to teach it in the schools?
There's a program, but it's not effective. I think only. Well, they're teaching it, but I don't think it's effective. I don't think kids are learning it. You know, I mean, they don't speak it at home, and so it's. I think the only place in the chain where the language really has a chance is Atka. You know. Yeah.
Yeah.
Unless something happens, you know, unless. The school won't be able to do it.
Yeah.
They started too late.
The language program?
In here in Unalaska.
Yeah.
Yes.
I was just going to say if you'd like to add something, Mrs. McClassen, before we close, or any thoughts, we'll be back this evening. But.
What I said about selling my shares and stocks or whatever it is probably sound terrible to a lot of people, but that was just between me and my husband.
Yeah.
You know, we were talking about it. I've been behind everything the kids were talking about to keep the land for themselves, you know, all these years. But I watched my husband having a hard time breathing every day, you know, he's sick, and that kind of changed my tune a little bit. I don't really know if he'll sell anything. But I just brought that up to find out how other people think about it.
Well, I'm glad you did.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, it could sell it back to the corporation, yes. That's what I would do that first. Yeah, well, I came from St. George Island, you know, where the natives are natives. You got no say in nothing there. So it was kind of tough living there when I was growing up.
Well, we're going to St. Paul later in the week, so.
Yeah, I'm from St. George.
Have people from St. George come?
Yes, my family moved to St. Paul a long time ago, but I stayed with my grandparents.
Yeah.
Anyway, I moved from there because they're trying to squash me down.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't going to take that. I've been a fighter all my life, I think.
Well, thanks very much. Did you, ma'am, want to say anything? Well, Mr. Swanson, maybe we could ask you to make any last observations before we adjourn for the afternoon.
No, I don't think I have anything new that hasn't been discussed already.
Okay. Well, if it's okay with everybody, I think that I'll just say thanks for the contributions that each of you made. We've heard from a dozen people this afternoon, and I think it's been worthwhile. It's been helpful to me, and I hope we've all learned something. And we're going to come back at 7 o'clock tonight, so people who couldn't make it this afternoon can come tonight. And if you want to come back, I sure hope you do. And if you want to ask any more questions or say anything else, we can just carry on with this talk then. So we'll see you at 7 o'clock. Well, thank you, Mr. Swanson, for coming. Well, I'll call our little gathering to order. Maybe we could start our meeting tonight and well, let me start the meeting by thanking you all for coming. My name is Tom Berger, and I'm conducting the Alaska Native Review Commission, and I've been traveling all over Alaska to every region to find out what people living out here in the Aleutians and in every other part of the state think about the land claim settlement of 1971. What difference has it made here in your community and in your region? What difference has it made to you personally? How is it working out? How are the corporations working out? I'd like to hear the good side and the bad side. Because like most things in life, I assume there is a good side and a bad side. And I'd like to know what you have to say about the 1991 issues. Everywhere we've gone in Alaska, people have talked about the prospect of sale of shares in the corporations, the native corporations, becoming up for sale after 1991, and they're concerned, and they've been expressing their view about the question whether they should sell their shares or not. Some people say that the shareholders in the corporation shouldn't sell their shares because if enough shares are sold, somebody could take over the corporation. Some outsider, somebody from Anchorage, a corporation from Seattle, Japan, New York, wherever. And the native land that was intended to be protected in perpetuity under the land claim settlement would be lost to the native people. But on the other hand, some people say, well, look, Congress intended that we got these shares back in 71. 20 years later, we should have the right to sell them. And if we sell them, we can get some money and buy a boat or fix up the roof or buy a three-wheeler or, if they're valuable enough, do all of those things. So why shouldn't we have the right to sell our shares? Then there is the question of taxation. In the years after 1991, the land that the native corporations hold will be subject to property tax by the state, even if it's undeveloped. There is no statewide property tax now. But some of the boroughs and the cities, of course, tax the land within their boundaries, and in the years after 1991 would have the right to tax undeveloped land. Then most places we've been, people are concerned about the fact that the children born since 1971 don't have the right to be enrolled as shareholders in the native corporations, and they're concerned about that, and they've said in meeting after meeting, why don't our children have the right to shares? Why weren't our children given the right to participate in this settlement? There are as much Eskimos or Aleuts or Indians as we are. And then the question of native sovereignty or native self-government has come up, and people have spoken about that question. The reason it has come up is because in most places we've been, people say that they do want to keep native land in native hands. So the question then arises, well, how do you do that?
some have said, well, let's get Congress to pass a law that says we can't sell our shares, or let's arrange for the corporations to buy them back if anybody wants to sell. Others have said, no, the best way to handle this is to separate the land from the corporations, have the corporations transfer the land to tribal governments or traditional councils, IRA governments. And I've said to all of those people, well, look, there are other possibilities as well. Let's keep them all in mind. There may be some ways in which we can combine the best features of the corporations and the tribal governments. Well, those are some of the things that people are talking about. I'd like to know how you feel about ANCSA, the land claim settlement, how you looked at it when it came in, what you thought it would achieve, and I'd like to know how you think it's worked out, and what you think about the prospects for 1991 and afterward. And of course, there may be questions that you're concerned about that I haven't even mentioned. Feel free to discuss those. I should say that I'm from Canada myself. I spent 3 years in the Canadian Arctic, going from one village to another to look at the land claims of the Eskimo and Indian people of the Canadian North. And I wrote a report for the Government of Canada, which people in Alaska have some knowledge of, and I suppose that's why I was asked to come here. I was asked to come here by the Inuit Circumpolar Conference, which is an international organization of Eskimos from Alaska, Canada, and Greenland. And they set up this commission, and they asked me to conduct the commission and to go around the state and hold meetings and see what people like you had to say. I've been doing all the talking tonight, but I will soon stop and let you express your views, but I think I owe it to you to explain why I'm here and what I'm trying to do. Now, everything that's being said and everything that you say tonight is being transcribed by Jim Sykes, who travels with me. It's taken down on tape and will be typed up, and we'll send to you a copy of everything that's said here tonight. We had a meeting here this afternoon, by the way, and we will, of course, have a transcript of everything that was said this afternoon and this evening, and we will send it to the Village Corporation and to the Village Nonprofit Corporation as well. The idea of taking it all down is that we want to establish a permanent record of what people living in rural Alaska really think about their land claim settlement, what they want to do about it, where they want to go. Because I intend to write a report about this, and my report will be based on what you tell me. And I want a permanent record of what's been said to base the report on. And my report will be made public in the summer of 1985. I'll keep on traveling through the state until early in the new year, and then I'll write my report, and it'll be ready in the summer. It'll be made public, and copies will be sent to you. And in it, I will set out your own views about how the land claim settlement has worked out, the desires you've expressed about where you want to go, and I'll make recommendations about how you can get there. And I hope that I'll be able to make a constructive contribution to working out some of the problems that ANCSA has created. Mary Kenswick also travels with me, and she helped to organize this meeting, and my wife Beverly is also with me, and she will be taking one or two pictures tonight, if you don't mind. And having introduced us, let me say how pleased we are to be here. We had a very good discussion this afternoon, and about a dozen people spoke, including Mr. Swanson, and it was a delight for me to hear from Mr. Swanson about the history of this region and this this town, and to hear as well from the other people. The teachers brought down one or two high school classes this afternoon, and they sat in on the meeting, and so I hope they learned something, and certainly I did. So I wonder if you would all feel free to participate. We have no set order, and if you wouldn't mind coming over and sitting in that chair by the microphone to make your contribution. The only reason I ask you to do that is that it means it's easier to record what's being said. And if we can keep the proceedings informal and just have a talk among ourselves, I think that would be the best scheme. So we're ready to begin. I certainly invite the just to get things rolling, if any officials of any of the members of the board of the village corporation or of the nonprofit corporation would like to start off, that would be fine. But we're open for business.
You need my name.
If I may.
Kathy Grimness with the Unalaska Corporation.
You're the president?
No, chairman of the board.
Chairman.
I was in land claims before land claims was settled, so I followed the history from before settlement. And I think that I guess I would say I'd be in favor of extending 1991 simply because the history of land claims has been you had to make a decision right now without the proper information. Settling the act, there were time limits, and everybody all over Alaska and the lower 48 were making decisions based on their future, not having proper information. And so we are where we are today. We're still making decisions in time limits. And I think that 1991 is not very far. And the village corporations that are organized, and there's a lot of small villages that aren't even ready for what they're doing today. We have the act has been nothing but conflict for most of the corporations, the village corporations and the regional corporations. One example of a conflict of the Settlement Act is surface rights and versus subsurface rights. Right there, we have a conflict of who owns surface, who owns subsurface and surface, and who gives permission to literally change your land. The way the act states is that the regional corporations have subsurface rights and the village corporations have surface rights. Well, when the village wants to get some of that subsurface, they have to go through the regional corporation. And yet, it's the village corporation's land that they have to get entrance onto. There's a conflict. And that's just one of the, maybe it's major to us out here because it's so immediate. We have that problem. We can't even go get our own gravel off our own land right now. I think when they, that's the other problem that happened in land claims. When they settled the act, the village corporations did not have that much input into the act. That's therefore the regionals own subsurface rights. The village, and Emil probably could speak on that a little bit more than I could. I think you were during settlement of the village corporations. Before that, I mean, did the village corporations have that much input into the settlement of the act? I think that's a good statement. No, they didn't. So therefore, we literally have no control over our own lands. You know, if the regionals want to come in, and they have done it, and just take gravel or move a mountain, we hardly have any say-so unless we're willing to go to court to settle it. And that's the problem with the act, is every time we have to define a point in the act, we have to go to court, whether it's against our own regional corporation or a regional against a regional or a village against a village. They say the act was made by lawyers for lawyers, and I think that's a good statement. The other problem that I'd like to speak on is that, and you said it's been brought up throughout the state, is after 1971, the you're no longer an Aleut or an Indian or an Eskimo. You're just, that's it, according to the act. You had to be born and enrolled by 1971. There's no provisions in after that date set up for children born after that time.
You said that you were involved before ANCSA came about. What did you want to achieve in a land claim settlement? If you could turn the clock back to 1970,